Things had got complicated. It had been 5 years since my father's visit, and on the surface at least, it had been a placid time, marked by the usual rites and rituals that America expects from its children. Marginal report cards and calls to the principal's office, part-time jobs at the burger chain, acne and driving tests and turbulent desire. I'd made my share of friends at school, gone on the occasional awkward date, and if I sometimes puzzled over the mysterious realignments of status that took place among my classmates, as some rose and others fell depending on the whims of their bodies or the make of their cars, I took comfort in the knowledge that my own position had steadily improved. Rarely did I meet kids whose families had less than mine and might remind me of good fortune. My mother did her best to remind me. She had separated from Lolo and returned to Hawaii to pursue a master's degree in anthropology shortly after my own arrival. For 3 years, I lived with her and Maya in a small apartment a block away from Punahou, my mother's student grant supporting the three of us. Sometimes, when I brought friends home after school, my mother would overhear them remark about the lack of food in the fridge or the less-than-perfect housekeeping, and she would pull me aside and let me know that she was a single mother going to school again and raising two kids, and that baking cookies wasn't exactly at the top of her priority list, and while she appreciated the fine education I was receiving at Punahou, she wasn't planning on putting up with any snotty attitudes from me or anyone else. Was that understood? It was understood. Despite my frequent and sometimes sullen claims of independence, the two of us remained close, and I did my best to help her out where I could, shopping for groceries, doing the laundry, looking after the knowing, dark-eyed child that my sister had become. But when my mother was ready to return to Indonesia to do her field work, and suggested that I go back with her and Maya to attend international school there, I immediately said no. I doubted what Indonesia now had to offer, and wearied of being new all over again. More than that, I'd arrived at an unspoken pact with my grandparents. I could live with them, and they'd leave me alone so long as I kept my trouble out of sight. The arrangement suited my purpose, a purpose that I could barely articulate to myself, much less to them. Away from my mother, away from my grandparents, I was engaged in a fitful interior struggle. I was trying to raise myself to be a black man in America, and beyond the given of my appearance, no one around me seemed to know exactly what that meant. My father's letters provided few clues. They would arrive sporadically, on a single blue page with gummed-down flaps that obscured any writing at the margins. He would report that everything was fine, commend me on my progress in school, and insist that my mother, Maya, and I were all welcome to take our rightful place beside him whenever we so desired. From time to time he would include advice, usually in the form of aphorisms that I didn't quite understand. Like water finding its level, you will arrive at a career that suits you. I would respond promptly, on a wide-ruled page, and his letters would find their way into the closet next to my mother's pictures of him. TV, movies, the radio, those were the places to start. Pop culture was color-coded, after all, an arcade of images from which you could cop a walk, a talk, a step, a style. I couldn't croon like Marvin Gaye, but I could learn to dance all the Soul Train steps. I couldn't pack a gun like Shaft or Superfly, but I could sure enough curse like Richard Pryor. And I could play basketball, with a consuming passion that would always exceed my limited talent. I was living out a caricature of black male adolescence, itself a caricature of swaggering American manhood. Yet at a time when boys aren't supposed to want to follow their father's tired footsteps, when the imperatives of harvest or work in a factory aren't supposed to dictate identity, so that how to live is bought off a rack or found in magazines, the principal difference between me and most of the man boys around me, the surfers, the football players, the would-be rock and roll guitarists, resided in the limited number of options at my disposal. Each of us chose a costume, armor against uncertainty. At least on the basketball court, I could find a community of sorts, with an inner life all its own. It was there that I would make my closest white friends, on turf where blackness couldn't be a disadvantage. And it was there that I would meet Ray and the other blacks close to my age who had begun to trickle into the islands, teenagers whose confusion and anger would help shape my own.